A botched execution refers to an execution attempt that does not proceed as planned, resulting in complications, errors, or failures in carrying out the intended method of capital punishment. These complications can range from malfunctioning equipment, such as the failure of an electric chair or a lethal injection apparatus, to errors in judgment or execution by the appointed officials, leading to prolonged suffering or even survival for the condemned individual. Botched executions often raise questions about the efficiency and humanity to the chosen method of execution, as well as broader ethical concerns surrounding the practice of capital punishment. Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Dark History Podcast, where we explore the darkest parts of human history. Hope everybody is well. I'm Rob, your host as always. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 8, Tales of Botched Executions, Part 2. I did the first part of this episode way back in Season 1, and I thought that in today's episode, I could bring you some more of these stories. In this episode, we will explore the haunting tales of executions gone awry, shed light on the grim realities and unforeseen mishaps that has plagued the history of capital punishment. From malfunctioning equipment to unexpected interventions, each story serves as a poignant reminder of the complexity and moral dilemmas inherent in the practice of carrying out the ultimate penalty. So without further ado, please turn off those lights, sit back, and relax next to the fire for more dark history. John Henry George Lee was born in the tranquil village of Abbot Skirwell in August of 1864, where he spent his formative years immersed in the rural charm of his surroundings. Following his academic endeavours, he embarked on a journey into the world of employment, finding himself in the service of Emma Kays, a notable spinster residing at the Glen in a serene coastal enclave, affectionately known as the Babbacombe in those days. However, the tides of fate soon led him down a different path, as he answered the call to duty and enlisted in the esteemed British Navy at Devonport. Despite his valiant service, a cruel twist of fate intervened, resulting in his premature discharge due to an injury after a mere 3 years of dedicated service. Undeterred by adversity, Lee sought a new opportunity, eventually finding employment under the esteemed Colonel Brownlow, who presided over a stately residence of Ridge Hill in the bustling town of Torquay. Yet amidst the grandeur of his new surroundings, temptation proved too great a foe, as he found himself entangled in a regrettable incident. The year of 1883 marked a somber chapter in John Lee's life, as he was faced with the consequences of his actions. Convicted of theft of silverware valued at £20 from his esteemed master, he stood before the court with a heavy heart. Despite his admission of guilt, justice was swift and unforgiving, casting him into the depths of Exeter Prison for a term of 6 months of hard labour. Following his release from the confines of Exeter Prison in the year of 1884, Lee found himself at a crossroads, grappling with the weight of his past transgressions. Yet amidst the shadows of his tumultuous history, a glimmer of hope emerged as Miss Keys extended an olive branch for redemption. Moved by the sense of compassion, and perhaps a lingering fondness for the young man she had once employed, Miss Keys offered John Lee a second chance at the Glen, the idyllic haven where he once toiled as a humble servant. It was here, amidst the comforting familiarity of his former workplace, that John Lee reunited with his half-sister, Elizabeth Harris, who diligently served the household as the cook. However, fate's cruel hand dealt a devastating blow on the late evening of November the 15th, when a tragedy befell the Glen in the form of a raging inferno. Amidst the chaos and despair, the lifeless body of Miss Keys was discovered, her throat gruesomely slit, shattering the tranquillity of the once peaceful household. The inferno, it seemed, was not merely a random act of nature, but a sinister ploy orchestrated by the perpetrator to obliterate any trace of their heinous deed. Suspicion swiftly fell upon John Lee, then a mere 20 years old, who, according to account, was the sole male presence within the confines of the Glen at the time of the harrowing incident. Fueling the flames of suspicion was John Lee's stained relationship with Miss Keyes, exacerbated by a recent altercation over his wages. Although the evidence against him remained circumstantial, the tendrils of doubt ensnared him tightly. A telltale cut upon his arm, allegedly sustained while attempting to quell the inferno's fury, offered a fragile alibi amidst a sea of uncertainty. Yet, in the unforgiving realm of justice, the burden of proof weighed heavily upon John Lee's shoulders. Unable to provide a satisfactory account of his whereabouts during the pivotal moments of the tragedy, he found himself cast into the merciless jaws of the legal system. Following a solemn inquest, he was inexorably drawn towards the hallowed halls of Exeter Azores, where the fate of his future hung precariously in the balance, poised upon the scales of justice. An inquest convened before a jury within the confines of St. Mary Church Town Hall, commencing a mere 2 days following the grisly murder that shut the tranquil corridors of the Glen. 25 testimonies echoed within the hallowed chamber, each haunting echo of the tragic events that had unfolded on the ill-fated night. Among the witnesses, the voices of Elizabeth Harris, the steadfast cook, and the venerable maidservant, Eliza and Jane Nett. They painted a vivid picture of the events preceding the heinous act. As a cloak of darkness enveloped the truth, the jury delivered a damning verdict, casting a shadow of suspicion upon John Lee, holding him accountable for the ultimate demise of Miss Keyes. Guided by the directive of the coroner, the solemn proclamation of willful murder by John Lee, forever intertwining his name with the chilling spectre of guilt. In a bygone era where justice often faltered under the weight of social norms, John Lee's fate hung precariously in the balance as the trial commenced within Exeter's Guild Hall on February the 2nd, 1885, represented by Reginald Gwynne Templar, a figure whose ties both to the victim and the accused lent an air of perplexing irony to the proceedings. The stage was set for a legal drama, fraught with intrigue and speculation. Yet, fate, it seemed, had its own designs, as Reginald's sudden illness thrust his younger brother Charles and the esteemed Liberal MP for St. Ives, John St. Alban, into the forefront of the defence. As the trial unfolded, whispers of scandal and clandestine affairs swirled amidst the courtroom, casting a pall over the uncertainty of the proceedings. Throughout the trial, John Lee steadfastly maintained his innocence. His protestations echoed within the halls of the chamber. However, amidst the flurry of legal manoeuvring, his defence faltered, with no witnesses called to testify on his behalf, and the prosecution's case resting upon tenuous threads of circumstantial evidence. Despite the lacklustre nature of the prosecutor's case, the jury, swayed by the prevailing winds of suspicion, rendered a swift and damning verdict, condemning John Lee to the ultimate punishment, death by hanging. On the fateful day of February the 23rd, 1885, Exeter Prison bore witness to the series of harrowing events, as 3 earnest attempts were made to execute John Lee, only to meet with failure each time. Despite the meticulous preparations by the appointed executioner, James Berry, the trapdoor of the scaffolding stubbornly refused to open, plunging the proceedings into chaos. Adding to the drama, the medical officer present adamantly refused to continue any further, leading to an abrupt cessation of the execution attempts. In the aftermath of the macabre ordeal, James Berry meticulously chronicled the events in his memoirs, My Experiences as an Executioner. Within its pages, Berry painstakingly recounted the minute details of the failed execution, shedding light on the adjustments made to the trapdoor, using rudimentary tools like a saw and an axe between successive attempts. Interestingly, while Berry's memoirs and his correspondence with the under-sheriff only allude to two attempts, the historical narrative speaks of three, shrouding the entire episode in an air of mystery and intrigue. The failure of the execution attempts prompted a swift action from the authorities. Home Secretary Sir William Hardcourt, confronted with the unprecedented circumstances, took the extraordinary step to commute Lee's sentence to life imprisonment. The Home Office wasted no time in launching a thorough investigation into the malfunctioning of the apparatus. It was soon revealed that during relocation of the gallows from the old infirmary to the coach house, a minor misalignment in the drawbar had occurred. This seemingly insignificant misalignment caused the hinges of the trapdoor to bind, preventing it from executing its grim task with precision. Despite the commutation of his sentence, Lee's plights did not end there. He embarked on a relentless campaign petitioning successive Home Secretaries for his release. His perseverance eventually bore fruit, and after enduring 2 decades of incarceration, he was finally granted freedom in 1907, making the end of a long and tumultuous chapter in his life. It was worth to know that the saga of Lee's failed execution is not an isolated incident in history. Remarkably, Joseph Samuel's name emerges from the history book, echoing a similar tale of resilience and survival. In September 1803, Joseph Samuel became the only other documented case in history known to have survived 3 hanging attempts, further highlighting the extraordinary nature of these rare occurrences. After his release, Lee seemed to have exploited his notoriety, supporting himself through lecturing on his life, and even becoming a subject of a silent film. Accounts of his whereabouts after 1916 are somewhat confused, and one researcher even speculated that in later years there was more than one man claiming to be Lee. It was suspected that he died in Tavistock Workhouse sometime during the Second World War. However, more recent research concludes that he died in the United States under the name of James Lee in 1945. According to the book, The Man They Could Not Hang, Lee's gravestone was located in Forest Home Cemetery, Milwaukee, in 2009. For our next story, we'll head to 17th century England and the story of James Scott. James Scott, previously known as James Croft, entered the world as the eldest offspring of Charles II and his mistress, Lucy Walter. Born around April 1649 in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, his arrival coincided with Charles's exile near The Hague, where his liaison with Lucy unfolded the year prior. James had a very turbulent and difficult childhood. Before he was even born, Charles had left for Scotland in an attempt to claim the Scottish and English thrones. When James was a mere year old, he endured a 10-day abduction suspected to be orchestrated by the agents of Cromwell's Commonwealth regime, possibly to eliminate the future threat to the republican rule. Seeking refuge and support, his mother, Lucy, relocated him to Breda and then to Paris, where she became involved with Viscount Taaffe, resulting in the birth of her daughter, Mary, in 1651. However, Lucy's relationship with Taaffe faltered in 1655, prompting her to return to The Hague with her children, causing ongoing scandals for the royalists. By January of 1656, Charles and his advisers, troubled by Lucy's actions, provided her with financial aid and sent her and her children to England. Despite a brief stay in London, the Cromwellian government's apprehension led to their arrest imprisonment in the Tower of London, and subsequent deportation back to the Netherlands in July of that year. Back in Flanders, Charles took custody of his son, James, amidst further turmoil. There were subsequent kidnapping attempts, notably one orchestrated by Charles's associate in December of 1657, which ended in a botched and public debacle. In April 1658, James was placed under the care of Lord William Croft, after one of Charles's men seized him and fled for 6 months. Tragically, James's mother, Lucy, passed away in December of 1658, leaving him an orphan at just the age of 9. In 1662, 2 years after Charles II had been crowned, he sent for James to join him at the English court. Although they had not spent much time together, the 12-year-old boy quickly won over his father, who was said to dote on him. Charles quickly began elevating James's position. Arrangements were made for James to marry Anne Scott, the Countess of Buccleuch, a wealthy Scottish heiress. Anne's father had long stipulated that any man who would marry his daughter would take his family name, so in preparation for the wedding, James changed his surname to Scott. On the 14th of February, 1663, James was granted the title of Duke of Monmouth, Earl of Doncaster, and Baron Scott of Tynedale, and given the precedence over all Jews not of royal blood. And in March of that year, he was nominated as Knight of the Garter. This rapid change in lifestyle, wealth, status and privilege quickly went to James's young head. Monmouth was living so extravagantly, within just a few years of arriving at court, he had run up debts of £18,000 by 1667, despite his enormous source of revenue, and had to be given an advance on his pension to pay them off. He seemed to care only for frivolity and fun, and soon his reputation suffered. When it came to women, he also followed in his father's footsteps. His relationship with his wife, Anne, was amicable but distant, and although they had 6 children together, 2 of whom who died in infancy, the first was not born until nearly 10 years after their wedding. Throughout their marriage, Monmouth had a string of mistresses, as well as casual liaisons. In 1669, he had a daughter with Elizabeth Waller. By 1673, he had an affair with Moll Kirk, a popular court beauty who was also fooling around with Monmouth's uncle, the Duke of York, and other courtiers. He met Eleanor Needham in 1676, and they went on to have an affair lasting around 7 years, resulting in the birth of 4 children. His final and well-known mistress was Henrietta Martha Wentworth. Even with all his womanising, Monmouth swiftly proved himself as a skilled military figure, demonstrating prowess both at sea and on land. At the tender age of 16, he served in the Royal Navy during the Second Anglo-Dutch War, aiding in the victory of Sole Bay under his uncle, James the Duke of York. Promoted to the Captain of the Cavalry in June 1666, he further ascended to the Captain of the Life Guard by September of 1668, a post secured after compensating the incumbent captain generously. During the onset of the Anglo-Dutch War, Monmouth led 6,000 English and Scottish troops dispatched to serve Louis XIV's army in France. His leadership culminated in the successive siege at Maastricht in July of 1673, garnering commendations for his strategic acumen. As Charles grew Monmouth for greater responsibilities, he entrusted him with the oversight of army matters, elevating him to a position of significant authority. With the passing of the previous commander in 1670, all army affairs fell under the purview of a committee reporting directly to Charles. However, by 1674, the king directed that Monmouth should receive all army orders first, effectively positioning him as a conduit for royal approval, thus solidifying his ascent within the ranks of the armed forces. In February of 1685, the dreaded moment arrived as Charles II breathed his last breath, ushering in the reign of James II of England. Meanwhile, Monmouth resided in The Hague, where James wasted no time in dispatching orders to have him apprehended. However, William of Orange forewarned the impending arrest, alerting Monmouth, enabling his swift escape. Amidst the growing discontent among Scottish and English Protestants in exile, plans to overthrow James quickly took shape. Within a remarkably brief span, Monmouth, fueled by assertion of his rightful claim to the throne and buoyanted by regional support, agreed to spearhead the rebellion, rallying the loyalists of the West Country of England to his cause. With a motley crew of volunteers, soldiers and local sympathisers, Monmouth launched his campaign against the new monarch. Despite his fervent belief in the cause, Monmouth's rebellion ultimately faltered, resulting in his capture by James II's forces. Incarcerated in the Tower of London, Monmouth pleaded desperately for his life, even offering to embrace Catholicism to appease the king. Yet James remained steadfast in his resolve, rejecting Monmouth's promises. Found guilty of treason, Monmouth faced his fate with a modicum of dignity. He was granted the privilege of a beheading, as opposed to the ignominy of being hung, drawn and quartered, as a concession befitting his noble lineage. On the 15th of July, 1685, Monmouth was led out to the scaffolding at Tower Hill to be executed. It is said that before laying his head on the block, Monmouth specifically bade Jack Ketch, the royal executioner, to finish him with one blow, saying he had mauled others before. Disconcerted, Ketch did indeed inflict multiple blows to the neck of the Duke of Monmouth, a ghastly sight that shocked the witnesses, drawing forth execrations and groans. Some say a knife was at last employed to sever the head from the twitching body. Robert Francois d'Amiens was born on the 9th of January 1715 in La Theuloye, a village near Arras in northern France. D'Amiens led a tumultuous life marked by the early enlistment in the army and the subsequent employment as a domestic servant at a Jesuit college in Paris. However, his dismissals from various positions due to misconduct led to his infamous moniker, Robert le Diable, or Robert the Devil. Despite debates about his mental state, some historians argue that d'Amiens was mentally unstable. Interrogation records suggest that he was deeply affected by the controversy surrounding the French clergy's refusal to grant sacrament to a Janicist sect member, leading him to blame the king and formulate a plan to punish him. On the 5th of January 1757, at 4 p.m, amidst the bustling scenes of the king entering the carriage at the Palace of Versailles, d'Amiens boldly surged past the king's valiant bodyguards, swiftly brandishing a penknife to strike him. Despite his audacity, he made no attempt to flee and he was promptly seized. King Louis XV fortunately wore a thick winter attire that offered him some protection, resulting in only a minor wound inflicted by the knife, which pierced a mere 1 centimetre into his chest. However, the sight of blood prompted Louis to urgently summon for the confessor, fearing for his life. As the Queen rushed to his side, Louis sought forgiveness for his indiscretions, acknowledging his numerous affairs. D'Amiens was swiftly apprehended and subjected to torture in a bid to extract information about his accomplices or the instigator. Despite these efforts, he remained resolute and silent. Subsequently, he faced a trial and was condemned by the Parliament of Paris as a regicide, receiving the grim sentence of being drawn and quartered by horses at the Place de Juive. Fetched from his prison cell on the morning of the 28th of March, 1757, Damiens, it was alleged to have said, "Le genie sera rude," or "the day will be hard." He was first subjected to a torture in which his legs were painfully compressed by a device called boots. He was then tortured with red-hot pincers. The hand which had held the knife during the attempted assassination was burnt using sulphur, molten wax, molten lead, and boiling oil was poured into his wound. He was then remanded to the royal executioner, Charles Henri Sanson. Ironically, Sanson would later go on to execute Louis XVI. After emasculating Damiens, they harnessed horses to his arms and legs to be dismembered, but Damiens' limbs did not separate easily. The officials ordered Sanson to cut Damiens' tendons, and once that was done, the horses were able to perform the dismemberment. Once Damiens was dismembered, to the applause of the crowd, his reportedly still living torso was burnt at the stake. After his death, the remains of Damiens' corpse were reduced to ashes and scattered to the wind. His house was razed, his brothers and sisters were forced to change their names, and his father, wife and daughter were banished from France forever. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this dark episode. The thought of being executed is terrifying, but then for it to go wrong and take longer than it should must make the person's experience 10 times worse. The beheading ones are just awful, because the person would more likely be alive when they're chopping down on their neck. Even in Damien's execution, it sounds like he was alive for most of it. The pain must have been unbearable. As for John Lee, well, he must have been one of the luckiest people alive. His whole existence thereafter hung quite literally in the balance, and all that was wrong was a misaligned hinge, and that is utterly madness. Anyway, if you could drop a review on the show, it really does help the podcast out. The more reviews, the more the algorithm pushes the show out there. If you think friends and family may be interested in the podcast, then share it with them. Links to all socials are below. I know adverts can be sometimes a pain in the backside, and if you would like ad-free content, the link to the show's Patreon is below also. Not only do you get ad-free content, here is where you can find my other podcast, This Week in History. This is a dive into the week's grisly, gruesome, or just random events throughout history. Patreon is for people who want to support the channel, but you don't have to. As always, if you've been listening for a while and not subscribed, please do that. In that way, you never miss an episode. So with all that out of the way, thank you again for listening. Join us next time for our next episode as we delve into another event and more dark history.